CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. Stream us anytime at www.ciut.fm.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to be talking about a very important book in just a moment, and we'll also, in the latter part of the show, we're going to be talking about the events, and your intuition will tell you what it'll be. But we have Phil Conlon with us. Phil Conlon is the proprietor of the program Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. And he's graciously come in to talk about this important book published by Cormorant Press, whose proprietor is Mark Cote. We've had him on the show. It's very, very articulate, interesting gentleman. So, Phil, thanks for coming in.
Yes, good morning. Glad to be here.
The book is has a great title, Housing for All. Couldn't be more timely. Housing is on the front page of the Globe today. Everybody's solving the housing crisis, so-called. And this book is called An Inside Story. Who's the author? What's this book attraction to you?
Well, The full title is Housing for All, How Toronto Built the St. Lawrence Neighborhood. And it is an inside story because the two co-authors, one of whom is actually a full-time professional photographer, but earlier in his life he was an urban planner for the City of Toronto and had a big hand in designing the St. Lawrence Neighborhood. So the co-authors are Frank Leuenberg, who is a lifelong urban planner and spent many years with the City of Toronto, and Vincenzo Pietropaolo. Actually, we've interviewed Vincenzo on CIUT. We did him on what was then the Friday morning show several years ago. He's now a full-time photographer, and his contribution to this book is 90% photography, but it's also he has some written contribution to the story as well. And what the book does is tells the story in great detail about how the St. Lawrence neighborhood, which was abandoned land, closed down industrial facilities, and pretty much ignored by the city fathers, I should say, maybe the city great grandfathers. I don't know. It was not on anybody's agenda. And Toronto was going through in the early 1970s something which we're going through right now: an acute housing crisis, a really, really terrible housing crisis. And of course, the big boys didn't want to do anything about it. But a group of municipal politicians, John Sewell is the name that comes up first.
For you.
Yeah, well, no, but also in this book.
I was kind of surprised all the other names that came up.
Right, yeah.
That I said, oh, that one.
A lot of names came up and surprising people. And by the way, it was not just the people on the left. It was people who were in the Conservative Party, people who were in the Liberal Party. Everybody who cared to look at the city knew there was a housing crisis, and there was land available, and so these planners and a lot of progressive social organizations. There was organizations of co-ops, and they built general co-ops, not just housing co-ops, and they built an organization for that helped develop housing co-ops. The Metropolitan Toronto Labor Council had a big role in this, and so a lot of the co-ops that were eventually built in the St. Lawrence neighborhood were built In partnership with different unions. The co-op that I live in was built in partnership.
Yeah, we didn't make that disclosure. You are yourself a resident.
I'm a resident of that.
Tipped the scale for us. We said we have to talk to Conlon because he actually lives there.
And the co-op I live in was done in cooperation with the Labor Council, and particularly with the Steelworkers Union.
What is your co-op?
It's called the David B. Archer Co-op, and David B. Archer was at one time the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor. And how the co-op came to be named after him is a story. I have the backstory on that because I sat down with...
Was it your idea?
No, I'm too young. This happened before I was a player. Not that I am. Lynn Williams, who was once the international president at the Steelworkers, and had a very, very nice old age sitting around and telling stories, right? So he told me the story of the naming of my co-op. He said we were in the process of pushing Archer out of power at the OFL because he just...
And the way to do it was to name the co-op.
So we told him, you know, you're going to leave, but we're going to name this big thing after you. Right, and Archer lived there. He spent his last days living there.
Okay, well, the joke's on Lynn. They named a street after him.
That's true, in Liberty Village. There is a Lynn Williams.
As they say in Sudbury, what goes around comes around.
Right? Absolutely. But there were lots of lots of steps in this development. But there's a lot of things that could have gone wrong. But eventually, I mean, they put it all together in the late 70s, early 80s. You
know. Well. And again, the title is Housing for All. It's the inside story, and it definitely is.
That's right.
Frank Leuenberg was right at the point of where all the key parties were talking, and he was
That's right. Yeah.
He was learning as he went. I was struck. Something he emphasizes, he says that the issue is rental, shortage of rental housing. People say, well, you know, we have housing shortage, but it's houses, an actual house, as opposed to an apartment, right?
Well, it's a mix. Quite a number of the co-ops in the community have a segment of townhouses and an apartment building. But in having a planned community, you say you want an inclusive community. That means you want old people, you want young people, and you want people with children who need a little bit of space, right, when they're growing up. So, yeah, we have in our co-op, just an example, we have like 60 houses, I think, and then about 100-something units in the building, right? So there's a preference for families with children to live in the houses, although it doesn't always work out that way. But that's the philosophy. Yes, the thing is that when we talk about housing shortages, and you see it in the news now, developers are always talking about, well, we're going to build more condos, which is not addressing the problem, right?
Yes.
And now, actually, they're kind of hoisting their own petard because now they've built too many condos and they can't sell them. The idea is that you had to own a house, your own house, and if you didn't, you were out of luck. Whereas the theory is that rental housing is a very important component in living in cities, right? Yeah. And in many countries in the world, this is recognized, right? It's always hard to get it recognized here. And they said, well, the idea, the rental co-ops, for instance, are not for profit. They're owned by cooperative corporations. The principle is you don't bring any equity in when you move in. You don't take any equity out when you leave. Or when you die, so it's not like something. Okay, well, my kids are lucky. I'm going to die someday, and they're going to inherit my house, right? Which is how it works in all the neighborhoods where people privately own houses, and that doesn't help people who aren't going to inherit a house, right? So, so the idea is you build housing for where people can afford to move in the first place, right? Mm. I mean, to buy a house in Toronto right now, you have to really have hit the lottery or have two.
Did you say win the lottery?
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. Which of course nobody does.
That's
right?
A little. That's a tip.
Yeah, that's a tip.
You want to have a house in Toronto?
Yeah. Buy a lottery
buy
ticket.
Buy a lottery ticket.
Doug Ford will sell you a lottery ticket.
Or you can bet 365 days a year at 24/7.
That
your chances are increased.
Where as they say,
ending up broke on the corner.
What's the advertising slogan? There's nothing ordinary. Yeah. Well, no, there is something ordinary about gambling. You lose. That's what's ordinary.
Yes. Yes, the house wins.
The house.
Try to remember that.
Yeah.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Our guest is Phil Conlon. We're talking about this new book, Housing for All, the inside story of a success. And it really, they don't always have successes. And by the way, Phil, I was struck by this, they discuss failure. They talk about problems with Regent Park. They're very candid. It was good discussion of what the problem was at Regent Park and Jamestown. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, it's a great discussion about Regent Park. So Regent Park, which was built at a time when a lot of American cities were building projects like that, and by the way, I've learned years ago that the word to call a cluster of housing for working class people, a project, is a terrible term because it carries with it
immediate stigmatization.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way, they raise that word.
Right. Yeah.
Because once a neighborhood gets a stigma,
right,
you're done. I mean, the guy says, "Where are you from?" Yeah. As you know, by the way, you grew up in New York City. Somebody says, "Where are you from?" He says, "Bed-Stuy." Uh-oh, trouble.
Right. Yeah. Or I'm from the Bronx. Oh, poor you. Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know. So Regent Park was intended as working class housing after World War II, but there was a key design failure. It was the progressive thinking at the time. We're going to create a little inward looking community with courtyards, but it actually what it does is it cuts the community off from outside. So as the city develops, that community is kind of sitting there looking across the courtyard at the neighbors, but they're not looking at the wider world, right? And then, of course, it comes to pass in Toronto, as capitalism has more and more problems, that unemployment gets higher and higher. So you have more and more unemployed people living in this housing, and you have a concentration of unemployed people, and then you get the kind of social issues that go with that, like drug dealing, for instance, because some people do it because there's no other way to earn a living, right? And then, of course, we demonize them, right? And we spend a lot of money on the police to beat them up, but no other, we don't spend anything else on them, right?
Yeah. The I was struck, I mean, these guys are architects, city planners, and it's very interesting to follow the thought process and the fact that you have theories about what will work. For example, what they thought was going to work, it seemed like a good idea, almost what they call it, a garden idea.
Right, that's right.
But they point out it's important to have through streets. There were no through streets.
That's right.
And so you really create an isolated community.
Right, and I could even show you people in the St. Lawrence neighborhood, which is not part of this development, but more recent, was built as public housing, which is an example of where that is. So I have living just to the east of me. It's a high rise with a handful of townhouses at ground level, and it has this huge courtyard. And that courtyard, basically, I've lived there for more than 30 years, and that courtyard is empty 95% of the time. And I said, this didn't work. This is a good example of what shouldn't have been done, but it was done by a provincial
planner. And what was it that was the error?
Well, the error is that courtyard doesn't serve any purpose and nobody goes into it, right? And it's not taken care of. I mean, there's a lot of people live in the surrounding building, but at least they look outward, right? Which is nice. But one of the nice things in the urban planning in the neighborhood is that the public library is in a courtyard which has a direct walkway to a main street, which is Front Street, and there's a balcony of residential units. So when you get up in the morning, you look out the window, you look at the courtyard, and you're looking at the library. I mean, that's a very nice.
Doug Ford thinks we ought to be selling donuts.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. He'd replace the library with.
It'd be better to have donuts.
Yeah, with the Tim Hortons, right?
We're talking to Phil Conlon, Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. And the book is
Housing for All.
Housing for All, he said, grasping for notes. Housing for All. It's Cormorant Press. And it is the inside story. It's a very candid and thoughtful book. Right. There's this thing of contrast. It was like they had well-intentioned ideas that didn't quite work. And then the idea for this, developing this community, is quite a story about how the author, Mr.
Frank Leuenberg.
He talks about his, I think it was him, it may have been somebody he interviewed, but whose job it was to kind of look around and say, where is there any spot in this city we could buy land and develop housing?
That was his job.
He would walk around the neighborhood and he would put a color code, we can buy this, so we can never do this, the other. But all he did was rethink the situation. And he and the others, when they looked at it, said, why couldn't this be? Because they said what you got there now are parking lots and blocks of old cars stacked up.
Yes,
you could easily move them.
Right.
They can be, they're going to go out of business. You can easily move them. Why not just do this? But this raises this issue, which now you raised the name John Sewell, and there's David Crombie. By the way, David wrote the preface. Found that fascinating. And I have to say, and I'd like you to enlarge upon it, you experienced it. Frankly, this was a unique generation. And I hate to say that, because at the end of the book, they're talking about, can we do this again? And I'd say, well, how many John Sewells you got? How many David Crombies? What's gone on at City Hall? And also, I'd have to ask you, you said unions were involved. So, well, where is the union component now? Are they saying anything about housing?
Well, the union component came to a sad end during the Mike Harris years. The Labor Council Development Foundation, which was a functioning organization, Harris came in and in his first 90 days when he decided to wreck everything, all right, and he did a very thorough job of wrecking things.
He was making Toronto great again.
That's right. He bankrupted and the Labor Council Development Foundation just got blown away. Into bankruptcy, literal bankruptcy.
Say the name again.
The Labor Council Development Foundation. This was the unions that was involved in developing housing, right? Mm-hmm. And Mike Harris and...
Where'd all that talent go?
It went to the far winds, it's a good example of what they... They were co-ops that were in development that Harris, and he bought this old hack named Al Leach in as the housing minister. And Al Leach had once been the boss of the TTC. He was a miserable guy when Harris appointed him. He destroyed every housing development that was being built, except for two, which were across the street from our place, because they were so far along in the development process, they decided it would be more expensive to blow them up than it was to complete them. So we allowed those two to be completed. They were completed in 96, and there has been one co-op that I'm aware of that has been developed since then, and that's only because we had this wonderful city councilor, Pam McConnell, who was a hero in the fight for housing for poor people, and she developed a co-op with the hotel workers union, Unite Here, and it was to address a particular problem that the downtown hotels had employees that they needed to have at work at 7 o'clock in the morning, but they couldn't afford to live in Toronto. So how were they supposed to get to work at 7 o'clock in the morning downtown, right? And so they developed a co-op, which is on Richmond Street East, which was in its initially, so this is about 12 or 13 years ago, populated by employees of hotels. And by the way, you could do dozens of specialized co-ops like that. You just need the political will, and you need somebody in government to care. But, of course, they don't care, right?
Yeah. Here's a phenomenon I'd like you to talk about. That is that the downtowns, which everybody in North America talks about this, at night, there isn't any such thing. Hmm. And it was mentioned by the authors that in this whole concept of, well, housing and what we're going to do, everything was emulate the U.S. Hmm. That the most of the big ideas, you remember the expression urban renewal,
yeah.
which was urban, you know,
urban destruction.
Urban destruction.
Yeah.
And even leading in the Nixon administration to the man who advised him, they said, what are we going to do about, there used to be a word ghetto.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? And he said, benign neglect. And
that was Mr. Banfield. Yes.
Yes. And so, but, so you have a bunch of problems. One is the tendency to imitate whatever the American thinking is. But then this, as they describe them in the book, determined city council said, no, we ought to have a city that is alive 24 hours.
Yes.
That after 5 o'clock there are people in the city. And that was a big contributor to this.
That was a big contributor to this, and it was and it was really going against the grain of what was happening in the U.S. They do mention, of course, there was one great historical event in 1971. Well, first of all, there was a particular American immigrant who came here roughly the same time I did in the late 60s, early 70s. That was Jane Jacobs.
Oh,
and she came here and she stuck her nose in the middle of all of this.
She's a saint that floats over the city.
She truly is. And she's an important name, not in the actual development of the St. Lawrence neighborhood, but in the thinking.
That's in life of cities.
That's right. I mean, she was a very important influence. People knew her work. They read her work. It was funny. Because I was coming from New York, I knew Jane Jacobs, not personally, but she wrote for the Village Voice, and she was there was a truly criminal person in New York State named Robert Moses, who destroyed so much of the cities of New York, right?
And happily,
he loved
enjoyed
it.
Himself.
He enjoyed himself. He blew up natives.
A big thinker.
And he intimidated every politician in the place. Well, she was a journalist working for the Village Voice, and she wasn't intimidated by him, and she really went after him, you know. And he was one of these guys that thought, like, oh, you don't get to criticize me, right?
No.
But Jane Jacobs did, and she came to Toronto in around the same time that I did, and she looked around here and she said, I hope you don't repeat the mistakes I've been seeing in New York. And the biggest mistake was they were going to put the Spadina Expressway, which is what we now call the Allen Expressway, they were going to put it right through to the lake, right? And it was going to go through settled, stabled, well-populated communities. They were going to knock down houses in the thousands and stuff like that.
Yes.
And
had everything but napalm.
That, and, you know, it could have gotten to that point, but honestly, the premier at the time, Davis, who gets all the credit for this, he doesn't deserve any credit.
He deserves some. You know, by the way, that raises something. The Red Tory.
Yeah.
There used to be a thing called the Red Tory.
Yeah.
And most progressives were irritated by such folks, but frankly, they actually were highly, they were pretended to be pragmatic.
Right.
And if you gave them a reasonable proposal,
right,
they would act on it.
Well, I mean, Davis built a lot of colleges and stuff like that, and I give him credit for that. I don't particularly give him credit for the Spadina Expressway decision because the pressure on him at that point was overwhelming, right? And he really had
He was
no
up
choice.
Against Jane Jacobs. I mean,
that wasn't even a fair fight.
Yes, that's
true. And so, I mean, it's when that thing got stopped, and he has a great quote, which he says, if a city is built for cars, the Spadina Expressway is a good place to start. If a city is built for people, it's a good place to stop.
I don't know who wrote that line, but that's a great
it's a great line. You know,
everybody that should be on a billboard somewhere.
Right. That's right, and it's
you're quite right. It jumps out at you.
And he's a figure in this book too. I mean, he's a distant figure, but I mean, it's like he certainly didn't interfere with what the city of Toronto was doing. Yeah. And now you look at the premier we have now; he interferes in everything, right? It's like this city shouldn't even have a government. That's really what he thinks, right?
Yeah.
He should be the government.
You
right?
need a, yeah. an executive yeah. of corpulent big shots.
That's
who,
a, that's
who
right.
know what's best for people. This is Taylor Report, CIET 89.5 FM in Toronto. We're talking about Housing for All, Cormorant Press, its inside story. Frank Lewinberg, and who's the second gentleman, the photographer?
Vincenzo Pietropaolo.
And by the way, there's great photographs. Of course, one of the photographs wasn't I'm sure Vincenzo's photo. It was from the Star, I think. It's David Crombie talking at a microphone and holding up Jane Jacobs' book, Death and Life of Cities. And people should have that.
Yeah.
Incidentally, and I don't know, Phil, if you've seen this, I keep twisting people's arms when I get an opportunity to go see this movie, or go see it, to find it on the internet. It's called Motherless Brooklyn, and it's I can't tell you the actors, but they're all great. And Alec Baldwin, plays Robert Moses. They don't say it's Robert Moses, but it's him. And there is a woman journalist who is fighting to protect people's homes from being destroyed by Moses, who is very much like Jane Jacobs. Now, they wrap it all up in a story about a detective from Queens. And it's brilliant. Apropos of our discussion, because it dramatized, shows how, you know, they go through the neighborhood and they're setting it all up to wipe these people out. You know, and say, well, you're going to have to move. You know, and it shows, you just described this, the conduct of Moses, shows him when he had to periodically make brief encounters with the real public. He was an authoritarian, arrogant character. And it beautifully done. Maybe it's a title, Motherless Brooklyn. Who can remember that? That's the name, by the way, of a character who suffers from autism, by the way, which makes him... the film even more fascinating. But back to our story. The authors deal with the problem, we've been talking about it here, frankly, without meaning to, but that was a rather culturally significant moment in history. They say, I found it very kind of... challenging, that they say, okay, well, this is a success. So how are we going to create more? And they say, we don't have any answers because that was the last one.
That's right. That's right. All the conditions that were in place then, of course, one of the conditions was that people had to live with was the interest rates were brutal. There were some, for housing, for sometimes there were 20%. And our co-op had a 20% not quite about 17% interest rate on its mortgage, but there was also input from the federal government in the 1970s, and that's another thing that is part of the background of this story is Trudeau did not get a majority government in 1972, and in fact, Mr. Stanfield, who was a decent enough guy, it's not the same party anymore.
But he couldn't catch a football.
He couldn't catch a football.
That's it.
And he lost the election by 2 votes. But Trudeau had to make a deal with the NDP, which was led by David Lewis. David Lewis was a serious politician, and he knew how to wheel and deal. And money for housing, for working class housing, was a big part of the deal that he cut. So that government from 72 to 74 appropriated an awful lot of money for co-op housing, and they paid it forward. So in the future, another PM couldn't come and take the money back. So we got 50-year mortgages in the St. Lawrence neighborhood. But then by the time, by the late 70s, early 80s, the money got cut off. The responsibilities got shifted to the provinces, and then the Tories have never liked it. And they've never been good with the funds. So part of it is that what makes it work is that a lot of the units have rent geared to income subsidies, and that money, which was paid forward in the 1970s, is about to run out for a lot of the co-ops, and it's going to be interesting to see if the province steps in to help. I'm not holding my breath, but you can't tell. I don't see Carney stepping in to help because he's just not that kind of guy, right? But we'll see what happens. But one of the big successes of this experiment is that they deliberately tried to mix low-income people with middle-income people with wealthy neighbors, right? But but intermingle them all, right?
Yes.
Right. And now the wealthy, by the way,
An actual community.
The wealthy stood back for a couple of years and said, I'm not sure about this. But then they said, you know, this looks pretty good, and they're downtown. Yeah. And, you know, so then
maybe
the wealthy—
we should move in there and move them out.
That's right. So then they start, and I guess the first time that I realized that the wealthy really were moving in is I used to go to meetings of the Neighborhood Association. And we had a methadone clinic in the neighborhood that was very successful. It was helping a lot of people dealing with drug addiction. And then I remember the first time that a member of a resident of a co-op got up and started complaining about it and said they wanted it kicked. It shouldn't be in this neighborhood. And I remember getting up, and because we were talking to a provincial representative, I said, I don't know who she is, and I don't know why she thinks she can speak for this neighborhood, but we understand there are sick people who need help, and they're our neighbors, and we're happy to have them here, right? Yeah. And that spoke for the sentiment of that community at that time. Whether it's still the sentiment, I'm not sure, but of course it should be. You know?
Yeah. Call another meeting.
Right. Well, you know, you know, because the rich move in, and then they decide, we're going to take over and tell you how to do things, right? And
yes. Well, the first thing is to decide who can't be here.
Yeah.
You know, and start, you know, slicing and cutting people out. Again, we're talking about housing for all. Inside story of a successful, and I guess we're not going to use the word project, home building for mixed, and that really is key, because that discussion of the Regent Park, I thought that was rather brilliant, actually. I mean, it's a revelation for me. I had not seen it discussed that way. But stigmatization is just absolutely poison for any city.
That's right. Yeah.
Any community. Once you do it, you bad things are going to unfold.
I mean, the term that I grew up with in the U.S. was the other side of the tracks. And that's how you classified human beings, right? And that's how you...
it was called the wrong side.
The wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah, and where I grew up, there were tracks.
Yeah.
And on the other side was a place called the labor camp. Yeah. And those guys had to cross those tracks, not be run over trying to be trained. Mm. And it was understood. Mm. You're from the wrong side.
Yeah. And by the way, there are tracks in our neighborhood.
How'd they handle that?
There's a street called Longboat where if you live on the south side of it, your backyard leads to an embankment. And on top of that embankment is train tracks where GO trains pass all day long and freight trains pass all day long. So, I mean, I don't know that I'd want to live on that street, but people do.
I think I would like that, actually. Yeah. I wouldn't mind watching the trains go by.
Yeah, but it's hearing them in the middle of the night. And
wait a minute. They also, let's talk about that a bit. They went a really smart idea of construction so that they actually were blocking sound. It was designed.
Yeah, and
I don't know they block it, but they reduce it.
They soften it. That's true. And it's there's no problem with the houses on that street. It's not that they sit empty. People buy them. There's no empty units in the neighborhood. So to me, that's a success.
This thing of they went with now here's an they went with the Paris plan. Mm. Which is what, 4 to 6 stories? Is that right?
They did for a while. Unfortunately, now it's a lot higher. But yes. Our building was 7. Across the street is the Woodsworth Co-op, and they're also about 6 or 7 stories. And then there are some 4 stories co-ops in the neighborhood. It is a very nice. It's a very human scale.
Is that accurate to say Paris?
Yeah, because when Paris
has a limit on height.
That's right. When Paris was redesigned in the 19th century by the Baron Haussmann, they really studied up on what is natural for human vision and human, you know, what's a human scale, and they came up with 7 stories, and that's why people go to Paris just to experience walking what those streets look like.
Being amongst humans.
It's the most, because when you have 30, 40, 50, 60-story buildings, this isn't human, right?
Ding, 39,
yeah.
Ding,
yeah.
44. John Sewell told the story about the Queen came here once.
Yeah.
And, of course, John Sewell was considered a Bolshevik by the Red Tories. Some of them, like Crombie, liked him, sort of, I guess. At any rate, John Sewell said that the Queen came, and they were all at Queen's Park, and they all lined up, various officials and whatnot. He was the mayor. And the Queen was coming along and politely saying, hello, 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 whatever it is she says, said. And she came to John Sewell and said, oh, Mr. Sewell, she says, I like your policy on limiting the height of the building. And she was the only one that she spoke to. But she knew about him.
Yeah.
And gave him, you know, that's a boost, right? I
mean, of course that's a boost.
You know. The Queen was somewhat respected.
Yes, and I call upon all monarchists in Toronto to join us in fighting for buildings of no greater than five or six stories.
The current king, I think, had the same position. He's an urban theorist.
He thinks about these issues. He does. You know,
So the king's our only hope. I mean,
that's right. We got to get with the king.
Got to get red monarchists. Our guest is Phil Conlon. We've covered a lot of ground. Maybe I ought to mention one other item that jumped out at me. I didn't know this existed. That the community had the St. Lawrence community as they were developing this, the neighborhood, they had a French. They went out of their way to establish that, a French community.
Absolutely right. That building is thriving. It's a nonprofit housing building.
That's not a Canadian project.
That certainly is. But
whose idea was that, and how'd they do it?
That idea came from an activist group within the French-speaking community of Toronto, which is large, by the way, much larger than a lot of people realize. And they had a community organization, and they came forward with a project, and the project got greenlit. And the place got built, and it's still there, and it still is a home for people who live more comfortably in French than in English. You know,
What's it called? What's it?
I don't know.
Ah, we stumped him. He didn't win the prize.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's.
And I did the dumb lawyer thing where I forgot. I'm supposed to know the answer to my own question.
Yeah, right. But I walk past it regularly. You know, it's like
there he goes. Any day now he'll be speaking French.
Yeah.
No, I think it's again. Look, these were a bunch of dreamers, in the very best sense of the word.
That's right. Yeah.
And on going back to John Sewell, he was a lawyer. He got involved because he was representing people in a particular community. What's the name of the?
Well, it was around St. Jamestown. The Bleecker Street was the famous street where there was serviceable housing for poor people on Bleecker Street, and there was a proposal from developers to knock all these houses down and build luxury apartments. And very early luxury, when the condo boom was just starting. And Treffan Court, I think, was
that's
the name.
Treffan Court. He won the prize. He got it.
They won it, and they stopped this development at City Council, earning the enmity of the development industry. And the development industry never forgets, right? Their desire for vengeance.
And then Dennison,
right,
who they called the old guard.
Boy, the old guard.
Very curious fact about Dennison is that he started off as a socialist. I recall letters and articles in the Toronto Star saying a rather curious situation. Dennison used to conduct a socialist education system project. He later ended up being
the developer's guy, right?
Kind of a company guy.
Yeah, and
not unknown in history.
No, it's, and there was a whole parade of municipal politicians like that, and Sewell's a guy who stuck his foot in the door and wouldn't let him close it, and it was marvelous.
Look at that. See, he starts at the ground level defending people who are in a desperate situation.
Right,
he ends up councilman and then mayor, and with the Queen thanking him for his efforts. Man, a lot of fun. The book is Housing for All, a success story, the story of the St. Lawrence community, and it's an inside story by Frank Lewinberg and Vincenzo
Pietro Paolo. Yeah.
And the photographs in this book are fantastic.
They're amazing. They're
beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah.
And it's Cormorant Press. We really urge everybody to get this book. And it's got the read. Make sure you will, once you start reading, you will read it to the end of it, but and think deeply and act on the question. Well, okay, so now we need housing for all now, and how are you going to do that? And there's a model. You can act on it. Phil Conlon, thank you very, very much. We're going to take a break. Phil will stay with us, and we'll be back to talk about some other matters. Here's to Petula Clark.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where they never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of a gentle bossa nova. You'll be dancing with them too before the night is over. Happy again. The lights are much brighter. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown, where all the lights are bright. Downtown, waiting for you tonight. Downtown, you're gonna be all right now. Downtown,
at Petula Clark.